The Lolo Creek Complex Fire west of Lolo is now the number one priority fire in the nation. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetic.
And I'm Edward O'Brien, and that fire once again tops our news tonight on Montana Evening Edition. After two blow-ups in 2 days, the Lolo Creek Complex now covers 8,500 acres and is still on the move. Five homes have been lost and 200 homes have been evacuated as that fire continues its march east along the north side of Highway 12. News Director Sally Mock has been in Lolo all this week covering the fire and joins us now live in the studio. Nice to have you back, Sally.
Thanks, Ed.
Both the Governor Steve Bullock and Senator John Tester were briefed on the fire this afternoon by the Type 1 Incident Command Team that took over management of this fire today. What were they told?
Well, Ed, they were told that the future of this fire is very much in the hands of Mother Nature and what kind of wind she's bringing the next couple of days. You know, on Monday, Ed, when I first went out on this fire, it was 13 miles from the town of Lolo. Today, it's within 5 miles of town, and that's amazing growth over the last two afternoons. Just yesterday, the fire grew 2.5 miles in just over 4 hours, and that's when officials ordered all the residents of Sleeman Gulch to evacuate. Operations Section Chief Mark Goller told officials today they now have contingency plans to do a last-ditch burnout along Sleeman Gulch if the fire reaches a trigger point at Sawmill Gulch.
If it looks like that fire might impact Sleeman Gulch, then we've made plans to possibly do a firing operation to the west of Sleeman in order to stop the fire spread.
A burnout.
A burnout, that's correct.
And if worse comes to worse and it goes through Sleeman, then you have another plan to do a burnout next to really what is the community of Lolo.
A lot of that will depend, and even the burnout in Sleeman Gulch will depend on how the fire approaches that. You know, we're going to have to evaluate on a basically a case-by-case basis, a minute-by-minute case, based on what the fire behavior is doing as it approaches that line. It may be that we don't have to burn out from that line. It may be that we can use that line, let the fire back naturally to it, and utilize our resources to pick the fire up as it approaches that edge. If it jumps Sleeman and gets across Sleeman Creek area, then we have a contingency line that's between Highway 93 and Sleeman that we can also do the same thing. We have a number of options. Burnout is not just the primary thing that we would do, but it is one of the tools in our toolbox.
And Ed, you heard him correctly. They now have a contingency for if the fire reaches the northwest edge of the community of Lolo. And in fact, people in the Ridgeway subdivision are being given a pre-evacuation warning to be ready to go if necessary. And that warning is in fact being given to people as far north of Lolo on the west side of Highway 93 as Dead Man Gulch. And by the way, that's hundreds of people who would be evacuated if it comes to that.
Okay, let's just be crystal clear here. No one in Lolo is being evacuated right now. This is strictly precautionary for the worst case scenario.
That's correct.
Okay, how are they doing for resources? And I ask because I know a Type 1 team usually gets what it wants.
Well, that's true. If those resources are available, and they're stretched very thin across the country right now with fires in California and Colorado and Idaho. But that said, yesterday there were about 80 firefighters on the Lolo Creek fire, and today there are 360, and that number is growing as we speak. The fire camp was really getting big as I was out there today. And they're also getting more helicopters in, and they are doing tanker retardant drops on the eastern flank of the fire to try to at least slow it down. And Governor Bullock is sending nearly 100 National Guard soldiers to help out with security and road closures.
We just mobilized essentially 85 guardsmen to join in the efforts and to do everything we can to make sure that people aren't losing their home.
And, Ed, the governor is also sending some of the guards Black Hawk helicopters to help out as well. They're supposed to arrive, I think, on Thursday.
Okay. And so then the Lolo complex is the number one, again, priority fire in the country right now.
That's right. It is. And Senator John Tester echoed the fact that concern about this fire now goes well beyond Lolo.
You know, I think the hearts, minds, and prayers of every Montanan out there looking at this fire saying, geez, we wish the best for those folks. But, you know, there's pros on the ground out here that know what they're doing, and that's a very, very good thing. And I know this community's been very receptive to their suggestions, and I just hope that continues and the best can come out of a bad situation.
And Sally, this is a bad situation for those people who've been evacuated and are worried about losing their homes, and I know you spoke to some of them today.
I did, Ed. And Kathleen Stokowski and Chris Barnes were evacuated from their home up Sleeman Gulch last evening, and this was right after the public meeting we were all attending and right before the latest fire blow up.
You know, it had been a calm day, and things were going to be relatively safe, and so we thought, we breathed a sigh of relief, headed home, got as far as the end of our road at Sleeman Gulch, and it was crawling with sheriffs and fire marshals, and they said, well, you've got to get out.
You were ready, though, right?
Yes, we were ready. We'd already moved out loads of valuables and just had to pack up our cats and leave the gulch.
Still frightening to have to actually go.
Extremely frightening and very poignant to leave your house and not know if that's the last time you'll see it.
Where did you end up?
We're staying with friends in Lolo. So
you probably prearranged that.
Yeah. And we're not too far away, and it's a place that the cats can freak out in a controlled environment. The dog is already at its boarding kennel, so she's okay.
Did you sleep at all last night?
Maybe an hour or two. It was pretty rough.
Especially watching the plume grow again as it did yesterday evening.
It was immense. It just dwarfed the sky. And, you know, to think that your house and your property is in the path of that is pretty sobering.
But today, you know your house is still okay.
That's what we've been told.
Yes, it's still standing. The fire is approaching, however.
And, Ed, a few of these folks had a window today where they were allowed back into Sleeman just briefly to pick up medications they had left or whatever. Steve Hackney was evacuated from his home near Fort Fizzle, and Marcia Hamilton had to leave her home in Mill Creek. And like the rest of us, they were also at that public meeting last night when the fire blew up.
We got trapped. We went to the public meeting and couldn't get back. And finally, we were able to get up the canyon. We had all of our trucks and trailers and stuff ready to go, but we couldn't get back to them.
But they let you through to go fetch them.
Let us through finally. And I know the fire had been right down to the highway, so they were pretty concerned about it.
So when you went to your place, what did you see?
Basically, the fire was just over the ridge, about probably a half mile from us.
Frightening sight.
Very frightening when everything you own is sitting there and you can't do a thing about it.
And you have to leave.
You have to leave, and you just... It's interesting to see what thoughts come through your mind and what things you try to collect is important when you're faced with a situation like this.
What were some of your thoughts?
Well, if it wasn't extremely important, it can be replaced. You know, and we don't have animals. Marcia and Terry have animals.
Marcia, how'd you get your animals out?
Well, we got two of the horses out yesterday morning, but we still have two up there right now, and that's our worry. So... we're hoping that they let us through sometime today to go check on those horses, but right now they're saying no. So,
when you left, what were you looking at?
You know, we watched the fire creep down the mountain pretty... it was moving pretty fast yesterday, but then the smoke filled in so much we couldn't see the mountain at all by the time we left. So, and the winds were what was, you know, the big worry, because it was so crazy and swirling around so much that it was just taking the fire wherever it wanted, pretty much.
Where are you staying?
My son lives in town, so we're with him.
Now it's just wait and hope for the best.
That's right.
And, Ed, while these residents wait and worry, the firefighters are out there digging line on the south and west flanks of the fire and, of course, preparing for those burnouts in case they need to take that action.
And, obviously, waiting to see what those winds will do.
That's right. And I spoke earlier today with the incident commander, Greg Ponson. He's a longtime veteran of fighting these major fires, and I talked to him about their plan of attack.
We got some folks out there today working hard to put some lines from Highway 12 up to protect those structures along the Highway 12 corridor and in Sleeman Gulch. We don't expect a break in the weather, and that's really been the critical issue for us. So the next probably two or three days are going to be a hard-fought battle out here.
As far as protecting Sleeman Gulch, it looks on the map anyway that between the eastern edge of the fire and Sleeman right now is very rugged territory. It's not territory you want to put ground crews, or is it?
We're still looking for opportunities, and those opportunities right now are to try and use topographic features like ridges or road systems that we can use to slow or stop the fire's spread. And so, again, that's some of the stuff that we're trying to get a handle on. We got a whole bunch of things we're going to be looking at. And that rugged terrain, and of course, firefighter safety is always the first consideration. And so that, at the end of the day, will be what controls where we put people.
Besides the folks that live in Sleeman Gulch are very worried about their homes, there are also people on the other side north of this fire on the southern edges of Missoula who are pretty worried as well, and that's a priority concern for you all as well.
Certainly, again, you know, we're going to try and anchor those control lines from Highway 12, protecting the structures. If all goes well, you know, we'll be able to turn that corner with these control lines working north and try and steer this fire north, and so we'll work it from that side, as and we've also got some crews working from the western flank, pushing to the east, so we'll try and corral that thing again as safety allows and as opportunities present themselves.
And as you say, the next couple of days really are going to be critical in terms of what happens with this fire and what you're able to do.
Yeah, we don't expect any break in the weather. So the weather we've been having, we will expect to continue to happen in the next few days.
Mr. Ponson, best of luck.
Thank you.
And Ed, some luck would really help them out right now.
Yeah, some luck and, again, calm winds. Now, there is another public meeting tonight at 8 o'clock at the lower gym of the Lolo School for people to get more up-to-date information. And they can also call the county hotline at 258-4636. Once again, that phone number, 258-4636. Sally, thank you so much.
Sure thing.
Well, the American Red Cross evacuation shelter at Missoula's Christ the King Church is now hosting a few more Lolo Complex evacuees after last night's fire run. The shelter was set up for a completely different situation. Officials discovered chemicals that they believed could be used to manufacture bombs. That neighborhood was evacuated, and the Red Cross shelter was created to provide temporary housing for anyone who would need it. American Red Cross volunteer Heather Jenner says this particular shelter on Missoula's Gerald Street started the week housing a couple of people. After last night's wildfire flare-up outside Lolo, that number's grown to 8.
We're lucky that we are in a community that really looks out for its own, and a lot of people are staying with friends or family in neighboring towns and areas, but we are still available if they need assistance. I'm not surprised. It's one of the great things about living in Montana and in this area. I used to live in larger cities, and we just live in a great area that really is concerned for its neighbors and community members, and we value that as Red Cross staff, but we're still here in case anyone might need assistance.
The Red Cross shelter's pet policy may also limit the number of people who can stay there.
We don't shelter the animals here. They have to go either to fairgrounds or Humane Society for sheltering of larger animals. And so that might also cause people who want to stay close to their animals to maybe not shelter here with us, but shelter with a family member or closer to those locations.
Catherine Orlowski, her husband Kevin, and their two kids live near Mill Creek on the north side of Highway 12. They'd already removed lots of their belongings from their home earlier this week, just in case an evacuation order was issued.
After the fire meeting at 5:30 at the Lolo School, we went up to our house one more time and to get last-minute stuff and move the water sprinklers. And we saw the fire on the top of our mountain to the west, I guess. And I swear, in 10 minutes, it came down halfway, if not almost going down the mountain. And it scared us so much. And we got out of there right away because it was that alarming. I mean, it felt like it was moving faster than our cars. Like, it was, we couldn't believe how fast it was moving. We'd never seen anything like that before.
Orlowski says her family's so grateful for the Red Cross shelter.
Us Lolo Creek up the creek people are kind of stubborn, and a lot of us wanted to stay there, you know, and a lot of our neighbors were, those stubborn ones were leaving too. And so we were very happy that we could come here. It's been great. We were worried that we'd be in a gym type room as a family. That would be hard, but they have individual rooms. Red Cross has been absolutely amazing. And I, historically speaking, haven't been huge on charities. I've been real skeptical, but they have proven their worth in helping, because we had nowhere else to go. We had some friends we could go to, but tight situations, hard situations, you know. I appreciate our friends and whatnot, but we kind of just needed our own space to grieve and just kind of just be alone as a family, and it's been super great here.
Lots of people have wanted to drop off homemade meals and treats to the Red Cross shelter at Missoula's Christ the King Church, but the agency can only accept food from certified kitchens. Again, donations can also be made via redcross.org.
Montana schools are improving school lunches at one of the fastest rates in the nation. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says Montana is one of six states where 98% of schools or more are meeting new meal standards set by the federal government. In tonight's feature interview, Capitol reporter Dan Boyce speaks with USDA Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services Kevin Concannon about the intent of these major revisions. Concannon says they were the first required changes to the National School Lunch Program in several decades, one that serves about 33 million children across the country every school day.
And the changes that were introduced last year required in all schools participating across the country, that's 99% of all the public schools and a significant portion of private and parochial schools, required that fruits and vegetables be served every day. That was a change. Required that a substantial increase in whole grain-rich foods in the rolls or pastas or even pizza dough. The milk had to be fat-free or 1% fat milk. For the first time in the history of the program, which has been going since the end of World War II, just after World War II ended, for the first time, we have not only minimum calorie levels, age-adjusted, but maximum calorie levels, again, age-adjusted for the child. And there is a requirement to reduce the amounts of saturated fat, trans fats, and sodium or salt in the meal. So there were major changes.
Two states, Florida and Colorado, had 100% of their school districts certified in meeting these new meal standards. And then four states, North Carolina, South Carolina, Oklahoma, and Montana, certified more than 98% of their districts. Just exactly what kind of an undertaking is that?
That's a huge undertaking. And what it points to is that both the state leadership and the education department in those respective states, but also the local nutrition directors of school systems, were prepared and committed to make this happen. And even in those states like Montana, where, again, they're one of obviously the top six states in the country, we anticipate before the books are closed, the state will get to 99-plus or 100%. Because typically it's smaller systems that had big challenges in making these adjustments. And so we've encouraged state agencies as well as the federal folks. In the case of Montana, there would be people out of our Denver office to work closely with the state and with the school system to help them come into compliance. And the advantage to the school systems is that they will be reimbursed an additional 6 cents per meal for all of those meals served during the past year, as a way of, again, incenting schools to come into compliance with these new requirements. And that new funding was authorized by federal law passed at the end of 2010, calendar year 2010, called the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010.
You talked about smaller systems perhaps having more challenges. Have you seen, looking at more urban states versus more rural states, like Montana, are more rural states having more of a difficulty implementing the breadth of these requirements?
I don't know that I've seen that, actually, because if you think about the states that are in that top six already, they're states that have pretty rural, major rural sections as well. I think it's more within states, whether they're northeastern urban states or upper Midwest, it's more some of the smaller school systems where they may not have the personnel, where the same people who prepare the meals, do the menus and collect the fees and, do everything but carry out the trash. And they may do that too. And so I think those have been more typically the places that needed the extra help, because this does represent change, and change comes easier sometimes to folks based on your history with change, whereas other folks we often hear, you know, we've done it this way for a long time, and why do we have to do anything differently?
Let's talk about some of the problems that the changes to the program has faced. An article in today's Great Falls Tribune, it has this interview with one school food services manager saying the new standards were difficult to realistically handle. More or less, she points to protein restrictions. She has this quote in the article that's saying, "You can't make a quarter-pound hamburger with 2 ounces of bread and 2 ounces of meat." A 2 ounce hamburger does sound pretty ridiculous, sir. In the article, though, you say some of these issues have been addressed.
They were. About the only significant issues, even though these were, again, as I said, the first new standards in decades, we had to make an adjustment in the middle of the year last year, which we were able to do in two categories. One was in the protein requirement, and that's where hamburger would come in, where we said to schools, look, you may serve as much protein as you wish, as long as you don't exceed the overall calorie limits for those students, age adjusted. And similarly, we made the same kind of adjustment for grains, where students, particularly in some of the middle school students or high school students, would want an additional roll or additional rolls. And we said, you may do so, again, as long as it doesn't exceed the calorie limitations. And once we issued that authority, the complaints and the challenges just disappeared, basically.
Ultimately, what kind of a difference can these altered meals make for kids, maybe especially kids that come from a background or a home where they don't receive proper nutrition?
Well, they can make huge differences, both in the ability of the child to learn. There's lots of research out there that shows that a consistent, healthy diet helps that child to be able to concentrate and to benefit from, you know, the investment we're making on the education side. But we've also seen encouraging news just in the last couple of weeks from the Centers for Disease Control, in which they published for the first time data that shows that we may be turning the corner in major sections of the U.S. on the challenges of obesity. It was the first time that we didn't see the rates of obesity going up in something like 18 states, and then actually slight reductions in those states, and then a similar number of states where there was no change, and then a small number of states where the rate was continuing to go up. And among the many items cited by CDC contributing to that promising news was the Women, Infants, and Children's program that we operate with states across the country. And we introduced a new meal pattern in it several years ago. We're already seeing the results of that with very young children. I am confident that several years out, we will see promising results from these new meal standards for students throughout the age ranges from kindergarten to grade 12. For low-income students, you know, many of these students, it may be more than half of the nutrition, the foods they're going to consume during the day. And we know that again, we, especially with younger children, we can inculcate those students with healthy eating habits right from their earliest years in school, and it can make a difference through the life course. I was at a school this time last year in New Orleans, sitting between two little first or second graders, and I was so fascinated by how interesting and energized these two little girls were telling me about their school, that I wasn't keeping up with them in terms of consuming the food in front of me. Finally, one of them looked up at me and said, "Mister, if you're not going to finish that broccoli, I'll finish it for you." And I have that picture in my office, and you can see the tray where my tray still has, you know, most of the food still on it, and she's way ahead of me in terms of eating. But to me, it was just an anecdote, but an example of where that child, having been to the school the year before, this was a school that's doing really great things in terms of promoting healthier, less processed foods, that we can train kids' palates to it, and we'll all be better off.
Kevin Concannon, USDA Undersecretary of Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services. Interesting discussion, sir. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dan.
In tonight's weather forecast, the National Weather Service in Missoula has issued a fire weather watch for thunderstorms, which is in effect tonight through tomorrow evening across the Clearwater, Nez Perce, Bitterroot, Deer Lodge, West Beaverhead, and East Beaverhead regions. Areas also in effect tonight through tomorrow afternoon are the Kootenai, Flathead Glacier Park, West Lolo, Salish and Kootenai Reservation, and the East Lolo areas. A fire weather watch means that critical fire weather conditions are forecast to occur. Air quality in Missoula and Lolo as of 5 p.m. this evening was good to moderate. However, the cumulative exposure in Lolo is hazardous. For west of the Continental Divide tonight, expect mostly clear skies with areas of patchy smoke. Lows will be in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Tomorrow, look for partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs will be in the mid-80s to lower 90s. For central Montana, tonight calls for mostly clear skies. Lows will stay around 50 degrees. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon. Highs will be in the upper 80s to lower 90s. And for southwest Montana, tonight look for partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows will stick around 45 to 55 degrees. Tomorrow calls for increasing clouds with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs will range in the upper 80s to lower 90s. And now for the editorial comments of Kelsey Stamm.
Montana summers are filled with great things for teenagers. Sports camps, swimming, family reunions, sleeping. But for 20 Montana high school students, a month of their summer was spent on an educational exchange in Cambodia. Through the State Department's American Youth Leadership Program, or AYLP, the Maureen and Mike Mansfield Center selected 20 talented young leaders and two innovative high school teachers to participate in an intensive environmental studies and cultural exchange program in Cambodia. Some of the students had spent time in a developing country. Some students had never set foot in an airport. But all of them had an interest in being immersed in another country and connecting their experiences as Montanans with those of Cambodians in order to view the issues they will tackle as future leaders through a global lens. The goals of AYLP are to advance mutual understanding between the people of the United States and of other countries, prepare youth leaders to become responsible citizens, spark an interest in learning about foreign cultures, and develop a cadre of Americans with cultural understanding who are able to advance international dialogue and compete effectively in the global economy. Following current events, the news of our world is often troubling. A lack of compromise in the political arena, escalating violence in Egypt, and an annual intensification of forest fires. But what I saw in our group in Cambodia was diplomacy and collaborative, creative problem-solving at its finest. I saw Montana students alongside their Cambodian peers planting trees in a rural village to combat climate change. I saw Americans and Cambodians together discussing the Khmer Rouge genocide and working out what justice means for their generation. And I was with this group of students hiking through a leech-filled jungle who, instead of giving up and refusing to go on when their legs were covered in leeches, kept going and took care of each other, and in the process solidified themselves in the knowledge that they could triumph over adversity. Not only did these students extend goodwill with an adventurous spirit that any Montanan would be proud of, but they gained a new perspective on themselves, their lives as Americans, and their place in the global community. Said one student, "We made many connections with environmental issues in both Cambodia and Montana, and were surprised to find many issues are parallel. I made connections between Cambodian students as well, and feel amazed when I think about how we are so alike, yet our lives are so different. The knowledge of these issues is very valuable to me, not only because it is interesting, but because these issues are my generation's future. It is us who will take care of them and continue learning to protect our globe. One of the high school teachers said, "I valued the opportunity to integrate with Cambodian adults and youth. It is so rare for anyone to have such a rich experience in a whole lifetime. To be able to spend so much time in another culture opens the mind and allows us to be much more tolerant of others. I don't think we can truly understand global relations until we spend time in other places in the world so we can begin to see outside of our small view. Seeing Cambodia from an environmental perspective was a great focus for opening our minds."